Shalom, Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We're in session number 27 this time. Let's review where we were our last session. Last session, we were in Daniel's time in chapter 2. We took a look at the statue, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar experienced. The dream was of a man. His head was of fine gold that stood for Nebuchadnezzar and Babylonian autocracy. As we went down the statue, we came to the breast and arms of silver that spoke of Medo-Persian oligarchy. Going further down the statue, to the belly and thighs of brass that spoke of Hellenistic democracy. And finally, at the base, Roman imperialism and republicanism was symbolized by the legs of iron and the feet of part iron and part clay. Now, Rome is noted for change, and Rome began, the Roman Empire, the Empire of Iron, began with the United Stage of Imperialism from 63 to 364 B.C., and this was the Roman Empire. This was the stage of imperialism that was marked by territorial acquisition, and you can see from the yellow arrow, this was a second time a Western power now dominated Jerusalem. The Roman Empire continued to expand to its greatest extent, and then it divided into a two-division stage, a united stage, and then a two-division stage. Approximately along this line, the Western Roman Empire was governed by Rome, the Eastern Roman Empire governed by Constantinople. So that was the purpose, the symbolism of the legs of iron. There was the United Stage, and then the empire divided into a two-division stage. Now, I noted for you that Rome, the fourth empire, the empire of imperialism, is characterized by change. From God's perspective, the Roman Empire did not fall and does not need to be revived. It simply changes form until it dominates the world. And we'll examine this factor, the factor that it dominates the world, in Daniel chapter 7. So the Roman Empire has to go worldwide. So we looked at the governments of the times of the Gentiles. Roman republicanism is a form of government that's the majority rules. So the structure is a sinful majority, but individual rights are allowed for the minority. Unfortunately, the result is chaos. The fact that we're influenced by Roman republicanism is seen, in fact, the whole world is influenced by Roman republican these days, is seen by this focus on human rights around the world. Now, this is not complete at this time. This is not universal worldwide, but the attempt is being made. The influence is always there. For example, in the United Nations, has this Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Human Rights Council. Now, that Human Rights Council is sometimes a bit of a farce, but the fact that human rights for the minority is being stressed is very much Roman republicanism. Also, on a worldwide basis, organizations have been developed to defend human rights. For example, Human Rights Watch. We talked a little bit about their philosophy and why they exist. And we also see the influence of Rome on a worldwide scale when we look at the summits that go on, the world summits that go on. This is the Osaka Summit of 2019. And look at all those men who lead the different countries in the world. They all look like a bunch of puppets. They're all dressed the same. They all want to be in the same club. The point is, they're all influenced by Roman imperialism. In this stage of Roman imperialism would be economic and political hegemony, influence. They're all influenced by Rome, all except for that guy. That's the Prince of Saudi Arabia. He hasn't totally succumbed to Roman influence at this point. And so Rome has just about gone worldwide at this point in time. Unfortunately, this will lead to a Judges 17:6 situation. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Every man sets the moral tone, and every man decides what his rights are. So chaos and anarchy is the result of focusing on my rights rather than focusing on my responsibilities. You know, focusing on my rights is where humanity has missed the boat. We need to focus on my responsibilities. So what are my responsibilities toward God, toward others, toward family, toward myself? These responsibilities and how to practically live them out are revealed in the Bible. And the problem we have is that the world has turned its back on the God who made this world, we've turned our back on the revelation from the true and living God who made this world, the Bible. The Bible is no longer influences the nations of the world. And the United States is rapidly falling away from biblical influence as well. We also talked about an alternative view to the Fourth Kingdom, that it would be the Islamic nations. And I discussed that with you. Then the smiting stone appeared. The smiting stone was cut from a mountain without hands. It smashes into the feet of the statue, and the statue representing human governments disappears. It's blown away like chaff in the wind. However, the smiting stone then grows into a mountain that fills the whole earth. And that is the picture of the Messianic Kingdom and Yeshua's worldwide rule as the king of the Millennial Kingdom, the Messianic Kingdom. All right. We also saw how this was, all that I've taught you is in contrast to amillennialism. And we talked about amillennialism a little bit. I gave you a few quotes from this book, Whose Promised Land by Colin Chapman. And again, I don't recommend this book. It is a theological view that is a contrast to the view that I'm giving you. You're free to explore it, of course, but I don't recommend that. In this book, we find out that the basic position of the amillennialist is that Jesus reinterpreted the Old Testament. What God said in the Old Testament isn't what he really meant. And Jesus begins to explain to us what God really meant. R.T. France, quoted in Whose Promised Land, takes this position. N.T. Wright takes this position. Colin Chapman takes this position, the author of Whose Promised Land. And he quotes Anthony A. Hokima, who again takes this position. Now, what you read in the Old Testament, even though it sounds like a literal return and setting up of the nation of Israel, isn't really what God meant. So that undercuts exegesis. That undercuts the veracity of the Bible. It doesn't mean what it says is basically their position. Well, we take the position of Rashi, for example. We take the position that the Bible, interpretation of the Bible, is based on consistent literal hermeneutic. A consistent literal interpretive position or grid. All right, we now come to chapter 2, verse 45, second part of the verse, as we come to the conclusion of the chapter. And we're back in Daniel's time during the Babylonian exile. And Daniel is speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, "The great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future, so the dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy." See, the great God has made this known to the king, made the future known to the king, not Marduk, not idols. Marduk is the patron deity of the city of Babylon. He didn't help. Just a piece of stone, a piece of rock, a piece of wood, a drawing, a fiction in men's heads. That's all Marduk is. He has no power, and he's not real. But the great God is, and the great God has proved himself real by revealing the future to the king, and so the dream is certain. Daniel has accurately described the dream, verifying his supernatural connection, and so the interpretation is sure. Nebuchadnezzar can trust Daniel's interpretation because he has received proof. He has received proof that Daniel has received revelation from the true and living God. Now, there's a couple of verses of additional affirmation that the Messianic Kingdom smites the Fourth Kingdom. For example, Revelation 11:15, "And the seventh angel sounded, and there was a loud voice in heaven saying, 'The kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Messiah. He will reign forever and ever. So Revelation 11:15 is a reference back to the kingdom of God taking over the kingdoms of this world. And then some details on the actual smiting by the smiting stone is Revelation 19:11 through 21. Here's some more details regarding that action. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called Faithful and True, and he in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. And from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations. And he will rule them with a rod of iron, as he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, Come, assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of commanders, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves, and small and great. And I saw the beast, and the kings of the earth, and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse, and against his army. And so the stage is now set. The stage is now set for the smiting stone. And what happens when the smiting stone comes? Well, it's really not much of a battle. Immediately. And the beast was seized. And with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who had worshipped the image. And that the two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. So one of the first activities of Yeshua's return is just to snatch these guys up and toss them away. Toss them into the garbage pail of history, the lake of fire. And then he continues. And the rest were killed with the sword, which came from the mouth of him who sat on the horse. And all the birds were filled with their flesh. So that's the end of the smiting stone. Now, at this point, I would like to share with you, I shouldn't say when I said the end of the smiting stone, I should say the end of the battle involving the smiting stone and the nations of the world. Yeshua goes on to set up the Messianic kingdom. All right, back to Mark Twain. I'd like to share with you some comments by Mark Twain. I think they're very significant comments. The quote comes from an article called Israel, the Inscrutable Enigma, that appeared in Israel, My Glory, November-December 2009. It is an excerpt from an article called Concerning the Jews by Mark Twain that was written in Harper's Magazine back in 1898. So Mark Twain said this. He says, if statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous, dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of. But he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people. And his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world and in all the ages, and he has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian, notice who he's focusing on here. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian arose and filled the planet with sound and splendor and then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Well, he's not quite right there. Rome is not gone. Rome is changing. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out. And they sit in twilight now, or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? See, Mark Twain saw the preservation of the Jewish community throughout history, but he didn't get it because he didn't know his Bible. The answer, Mr. Twain, is the Abrahamic covenant. It begins in Genesis 12, 1 through 3. Now the Lord said to Avram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to a land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. He promises Abraham that he will make a great nation in the land that Abraham goes to, what we call the land of Israel today. And I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and curse those who curse you. Those who attack the Jewish people are cursed. Those who curse us by trying to destroy us are then cursed by God. But Israel will also be a blessing to those who bless Israel. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. That's an ultimate look at the Messianic kingdom. Israel has been blessing the world throughout its history, but ultimately the Messianic kingdom is the apex of that blessing. So we have a covenant relationship with God, and he intends to fulfill that covenant relationship. And in order to do so, he must preserve the Jewish people throughout our history. So there's your answer, Mark. Glad you asked. Let's review the final four Gentile empires of Daniel. Remember, this is the course of the times of the Gentiles. Babylon through Rome. Babylon until the second coming. In chapter 2, we saw the image of a man. The head of gold was Babylon. The chest and arms of silver was Medo-Persia. Hellenism and Greek empire of bronze was portrayed by the belly and thighs. Rome is the legs and feet of iron and clay. And then finally comes the Messianic kingdom, which is the rock and the mountain. Now we come to verse 46, as we come to our conclusion of this chapter. And in verse 46, we see Nebuchadnezzar's worship. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel. And he gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. So he really appreciates what he's received from Daniel, or through Daniel, this revelation, understanding of his dream. But he goes a little too far here. But the man is a polytheistic idol worshiper, so he knows no better. But then he moves on. He does get better here in verse 47, where he honors the God of Daniel. The king answered Daniel and said, surely your God is a God of gods, and Lord of kings, and the revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. So he gets it right here in verse 47. And then his response is to reward Daniel. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts. And he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And then in verse 29, Daniel does not forget the role his friends played in this. Daniel's a humble man. He realizes he's had help. He realizes he has not done this in his own power and strength, and so he makes a request of his three partners in prayer. He says, "The Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was in the king's court." And so his three partners in ministry receive the benefit of the ministry as well. All right, let's sum it all up here. Let's sum up chapter 2. First of all, the times of the Gentiles will play itself out through the history of four Gentile empires. Secondly, the times of the Gentiles will come to a sudden catastrophic end with the second coming and the institution of the Messianic kingdom. Third, throughout the times of the Gentiles, the Jews will reach prominent positions from which they will aid their Jewish brethren. Israel will always be preserved. Let's go back, let's think of an ancient example of that. An ancient example is Esther 4:14, but we're back in 450 BC. In the book of Esther, we read that Mordecai is exhorting Esther, "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." and you and your father's house will perish. And then he asks this very, he makes this very important statement, or I should say it's a question, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. And that's the exact truth. Esther was raised to royalty so the Jewish people could be preserved from the genocide of Haman. So that's an ancient, ancient example. But you know, we have a modern example as well. And the modern example is Eddie Jacobson. Who in the world is Eddie Jacobson, do you say? Well, there's an article on him in Wikipedia. Edward Jacobson was an American Jewish businessman. He was a U.S. Army associate, business partner, and close friend of President Harry S. Truman. Now, here's a picture of Eddie Jacobson and Truman together in the store. Jacobson was a businessman. And here another picture of the two friends together. This time they're beside a Continental Airlines aircraft. But they were good friends. They were good friends and business partners. So guess what? He had open access to the Oval Office. When Jacobson first heard about what was happening to the Jews in Germany before and during World War II, he took to discussing it with Truman. After he heard the post-war reports regarding the Nazi Holocaust and its survivors, his talks with Truman about how to help the Jewish people became more intense. Because the Jewish leaders in the U.S. knew Jacobson was a friend of the president, they approached him to lobby Truman with even more fervor. Jacobson went to the White House on March 13, 1948, and at that meeting persuaded Truman to meet with the leader of the Zionist movement, Dr. Chaim Weizmann. Partly as a result of Jacobson's efforts, the United States became the first nation to grant diplomatic recognition to the new state of Israel in May 14, 1948. So there's another example of God providing the right man, the right person at the right time to aid their Jewish brethren. This preservation of the Jewish people has been going on for a long, long time. As early as 1600 BC, for example, through Joseph. That's Genesis 50, 17 through 20. Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your fathers. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. And Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? See, he knew his position too. He was just a servant of the Lord. And then he issues this great statement, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Why? In order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. And so God has been doing that throughout our history. The present result, preserving the Jewish people, happened in 1600 BC through Joseph, happened in 550 BC through Daniel and his three friends. It happened in 450 BC through Esther, happened in 1948 through Eddie Jacobson. It's going to happen throughout the times of the Gentiles. The history of Israel is unique. We are a unique nation among all the nations of the face of the earth. And that's exactly what Mark Twain observed. All right, let's move on. Currently, the modern state of Israel is experiencing the final empire of the times of the Gentiles, Roman republicanism and imperialism. This empire is characterized by change. In chapter 2, three stages of this empire have been revealed. The United stage in verse 40, the two-division stage in 241, and the ten-division stage in verses 42 and 43. And currently, we are in the two-division stage, the east-west balance of power. That's the two legs of the statue. Now, as we move to Daniel chapter 7, additional details regarding the Fourth Empire will be developed. And so we have finished up chapter 2. Let's move on now to chapter 7 of Daniel. The key verses are going to be 23 to 27. However, to get there, we need to go through some background first. So we'll look at the background of chapter 7, Daniel chapter 7, verses 1 through 8, and the four visions that Daniel sees. This chapter has also been called the four beasts. Sometimes it's called the little revelation, the little book of Revelation. Now, as far as the time frames go, we are back. We were started in Daniel's time, the Babylonian exile under King Nebuchadnezzar. That was chapter 2. We were under King Nebuchadnezzar speaking face to face with him. But now, as we get to chapter 7, verse 1, we're back at in Daniel's time, the Babylonian exile. But now he's speaking face to face with King Belshazzar. King Belshazzar has come to the throne. Now, I'd like to review that principle of chiasm, the chiastic structure of chapters 2 through 7. Chapter 2 dealt with the four Gentile empires. Chapter 3 with persecution. Chapter 4 with encouragement during persecution. Chapter 5 repeats encouragement during persecution. Chapter 6 shows us that persecution is still very much part of the time of the Gentiles. And chapter 7 deals with the four Gentile empires again. And so chapters 2 through 7 form a unit with the four Gentile empires being the bookends of that unit of thought. And remember the law of recurrence. Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 are a law of recurrence. This was explained in The Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Fruchtenbaum. This law describes the fact that in some passages of Scripture, there exists a recording of an event, followed by a second recording of the same event, giving more details to the first. Hence, it often involves two blocks of Scripture. The first block presents the description of the event as it transpires in chronological sequence. That's Daniel chapter 2, and our move down the statue from Babylon to Medo-Persia, Greece to Rome. And this is followed by a second block of Scripture dealing with the same event in the same period of time, but giving further details as to what transpires in the course of the event, and that will be chapter 7. So let's pick it up in chapter 7, verse 1, with the introduction to the chapter. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. And then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. So it's the first year of Belshazzar, 553 BC, 50 years after chapter 2. 50 years have transpired. This is 14 years before the fall of Babylon to Medo-Persia. 14 years before the fall of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar has been dead for 9 years. He died in 562. So Daniel has this dream, these visions. This is the first vision to Daniel proper. And this content is a further elaboration of chapter 2. It gives us more details, you know, the law of recurrence. So let's compare chapters 2 and chapter 7. A lot of comparisons have been done. For example, we'll look at the feature and then the two chapters. First of all, the visionary. In chapter 2, it was a pagan king. In chapter 7, it was the holy prophet. The interpreter in chapter 2 was Daniel, and in chapter 7, it was an angel. And the perspective in chapter 2 was man's point of view. The kingdoms are majestic. But from God's point of view, the perspective is different. The kingdoms are beastly. As far as the kingdoms go, chapter 2 deals with their outward political aspect. Chapter 7 deals with their inner moral and spiritual aspect. As far as the symbol in the chapter, the kingdoms are symbolized by inanimate objects, a statue and a rock. In chapter 7, the Gentile world is symbolized by four beasts. Human government is symbolized in chapter 2 by the statue of a man, and in chapter 7, human government is symbolized by their animalistic nature. The Messianic kingdom is a smiting stone in chapter 2, but we see the actual coming of the Son of Man in chapter 7. Now, Dr. Constable has some comparisons between Daniel 2 and 7 as well in his notes. He notes that Nebuchadnezzar's image was a statue, but in chapter 7 we have four beasts. The vision was given to Nebuchadnezzar, the dream, in chapter 2. The vision, the dream, is given to Daniel in chapter 7. In chapter 2, the vision, the dream, is four kingdoms plus one in view, and in chapter 7 is four kingdoms plus one in view. Chapter 2, the vision, the dream, consists of one statue and a stone. And in chapter 7, it's four beasts and the Son of Man. Chapter 2 is more general. Chapter 7 is more detailed. In chapter 2, Daniel did the interpretation. In chapter 7, an angel did the interpretation. Chapter 2 is from man's viewpoint. Chapter 7 is from God's viewpoint. Then Daniel, after receiving this vision, wrote down the dream immediately while it was fresh in his mind as soon as he woke up, and he told the sum of the matters, the summary. This is not everything that he saw. This is a summary, the key points for you and me. All right, so let's move to the first vision in chapter 7, verses 2 through 6. It consisted of the great sea in verses 2 and 3, and the great sea is being agitated, verse 2. And Daniel said, I was looking at my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. He says, I saw in my vision at night. This is significant. In the first six chapters, Daniel refers to himself in the third person, but now in chapter six on to the end of the book, he refers to himself in the first person. I saw this. I was beholding. And the grammatical construction emphasizes continuous action, continuous gazing, studious examination. This is a very deliberate and careful attention being paid to this vision. This is not some casual observation. Now the sea is being stirred up by an unusual source, the four winds of heaven, north, east, south, and west. That would stir up the ocean if the breezes, the winds came at it from four directions. And of course the four winds of heaven are the same number as the four Gentile empires. And this speaks of God's sovereignty and providence. God is and uses the wind. In fact, his spirit is the word ruach, and that the Hebrew means wind, breath, or spirit. Now, this wind and water motif can be seen in various places in the scripture. For example, Genesis 8:1, with the great flood. God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused what? A wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. There's that wind and water motif. And then in Exodus 14:21-2, we also see it there. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into a dry land, so the waters were divided. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. So these winds break forth on the great sea. They stir it up. They cause a tremendous disturbed state. And the great sea in scriptures is the Mediterranean Sea. The Mediterranean Sea. Many examples of that reference. Now, here is a picture of the Mediterranean in a disturbed state. This is a storm on Israel's coast. On my last trip to Israel, our first day of touring was a day of wind and rain. Or at least I say the morning was a time of wind and rain. Soon the sun came out and became much more pleasant. But you see the Mediterranean still was disturbed. The waves were still crashing into the harbor at Caesarea. And there they are, the waves crashing against the water break there. Very spectacular scenes. So the Mediterranean was being stirred up. And this stirred up state of the Great Sea, this disturbed state, is a symbol of the Gentile world. And I'll share with you five examples of this. Of this symbolism, Isaiah 17:12-13. Alas, the uproar of many peoples who roar like the roaring of the seas. There's the association, many peoples with the seas. And the rumbling of nations who rush on like the rumbling of mighty waters. There's that association again. The nations rumble like the rumbling of many waters, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away. And be chased like chaff in the mountains before the wind, or like whirling dust before a gale. And notice the connection, the association between the smiting stone smashing the statue and it being chased away like chaff in the mountains before the wind, or whirling dust before a gale. Same pictures used of the nations of the world being destroyed by the Messianic kingdom and the coming of Jesus. We also see this in the New Testament, Matthew 13. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet cast into the sea and gathering fish of every kind. And when it was filled, they drew it up on the beach and they sat down and gathered the good fish into the container, but the bad they threw away. And so it will be at the end of the age. And so the Sea of Galilee there is a symbol of the nations of the world. The angels will come forth and take the wicked from among the righteous. You know, the fish there from the Sea of Galilee symbolizes men coming out of the waters. And they'll throw them into the furnace of fire. And that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Revelation 13:1, we have this picture of the Gentile nations being portrayed by the sea. And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. And then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns were 10 diadems. And on his heads were blasphemous names. So the dragon, the devil, is standing on the seashore. And out of the sea arises the Antichrist. Then one of the 7 angels, which had the 7 bowls, came and spoke to me, saying, "Come here, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." And he said to me, "The waters which you saw, where the harlot sits," now is verse 15, interprets the picture, "the waters which you saw are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." So the great sea represents the ever restless Gentile world. There it is, the great sea being churned up, restless. Isaiah, finally, a final cross-reference, Isaiah 57, 20 and 21. "But the wicked are what? They're like the tossing sea, for it cannot be quiet. Its waters toss up refuse and mud. There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked." The wicked are like the disturbed sea. And so that's what Daniel sees, the Antichrist coming out of the disturbed sea. And back in chapter 7 of Daniel, he sees the rise of the 4 beasts in verse 3. And the 4 great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. So they're all beasts of prey. They're dangerous. They're vicious. So they come up out of the sea. So they arise out of the Mediterranean area, the area surrounding Israel, and they arise out from among the Gentiles. So this is the Mediterranean area and the nations surrounding Israel, the Gentile nations. And they're all diverse from one another. And they represent the same kingdoms we saw in chapter 2. We saw, first of all, the head of fine gold, Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, the breast and arms of silver, Medo-Persia, the belly and thighs of brass, the Hellenistic Empire, and finally Rome, the legs of iron, the feet of part iron and part clay. And here are the 4 empires arising out of the sea. I think this is a very well done illustration. There are the 4 beasts coming out of the Gentile world. Now we move to verse 4 and we come to the first beast representing Babylon. "The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked. And it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And a human mind was also given to it." So this first beast is lion-like. It is not a lion, but it is very similar to a lion. And the lion is the king of beasts. That's a symbol of Babylon as well. It's used this way in Jeremiah. It had eagle's wings, so this made it a bit different. We don't know of any lions with eagle's wings. And the eagle is also the king of birds. And this is also a symbol of Babylon in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Now, the Ishtar Gate in Babylon was also decorated with winged lions. Now, here's a detail of the Ishtar Gate. Let's focus in on one of those lions. There we are. And there are the wings. This is a winged lion. That lion is tucked up under its side and under its belly. Now, the events affecting the beast, the wings were plucked, it was lifted up from the earth, it was made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And so these 4 events hark back to Nebuchadnezzar's experience in chapter 4. In chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar became a beast for a short time. And as nearly as a man could become a beast, Nebuchadnezzar became a beast. And as nearly as a beast can become like a man, Babylon would lose its beast-like nature. Babylon would eventually lose its animalistic characteristics and become more humane. It lost its brutality. So these 4 events summarize the experience of Babylon from their lust of conquest to their building of culture. All right. Now let's move from verse 4 in Daniel's present time to verse 5 in the near future, and this is the Medo-Persian Empire and the second beast. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, "Arise, devour much meat." So this here's our four empires, and here is the bear. So this is bear-like. It's not exactly a bear. It resembles a bear. A bear is less majestic than a lion because it's bulky and weighty. Now, this represented the Medo-Persian army, the Medo-Persian military, whose army conquered by sheer force of numbers. Now, this bear is raised up on one side, and so it is a lopsided bear. This represents the union between the Medes and the Persians. The Persians were by far the greater and more dominant power. Therefore, this was a lopsided union. Now, three ribs were in its mouth and between its teeth, and Medo-Persia conquered three major kingdoms. Here's the Persian Empire. They conquered Lydia, Babylonia, and Egypt. These three ribs raised Medo-Persia to empire status. But then the vision goes on, and they said to it, "Arise and devour much flesh." So there was further conquest beyond these three ribs, and indeed that's true. The Persian Empire grew, continued to grow into a great size. And we have a little bit of rabbinic agreement with us regarding this verse speaking of the Medo-Persian Empire. We find this agreement in the Talmud, Kiddushin 72a, Rav Joseph recited, this refers to the Persians. And we agree, this would refer to Medo-Persia. And here he does a little bit of exegesis. Who eat and drink like a bear, are fleshly like a bear, overgrown with hair like a bear, and are restless like a bear. So that's not exactly a humorous description of the, a complimentary description of the Persians. It's kind of humorous. I enjoy it there. But it's not exactly solid biblical exegesis either. All right, let's move on from chapter 7, verse 5 to chapter 7, verse 6, and the far future, the Hellenistic Empire in verse 6. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So here are our four empires, and here's a close-up of the Hellenistic Empire. It's leopard-like. That's the primary feature. Leopard is less majestic than a lion, less grand than a bear, but it's swifter than both. And this is also a motif for the nations as well. Now, the leopard symbolized the speed and conquest of the Hellenistic Empire under Alexander the Great. Now, it had four wings of a bird. This made the leopard different. This isn't a literal leopard. And the four wings symbolize the division of the empire after the death of Alexander the Great. It was divided up between his top four generals. And the divisions went like this. Thrace and Bithynia, Macedonia and Greece, Egypt, Judah, and Arabia Petra, and then Syria, Babylonia, all the way to India. That was the four divisions of the empire. Now, the four heads of the leopard represent the four generals who divided the kingdom among themselves after Alexander died. So the four are Lysimachus, Thrace and Bithynia, then Cassander, Macedonia and Greece, then Ptolemy, and Egypt, Judah, and Arabia Petra, and then Seleucus, Syria and Babylonia. There's the division of the empire. These two, Seleucus and Ptolemy, these two would set up two kingdoms that directly affected Israel's history, because there you can see Israel. Israel is in the overlap between these two kingdoms, and so became the battleground between these two. Very, very important interaction in Israel's history. All right, let's move on now from 7:6 to chapter 7, verse 7. We are still in the far future, but now we're in the Roman period. Here's our four empires, and there is the last beast, the Roman Empire, Roman imperialism, and Republicanism. Verse 7. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So this fourth beast is unique and diverse and different from all the others. He can't describe it. It's totally foreign to anything that he knows. But he knows it's terrible, speaking of Roman brutality. He knows it's powerful, speaking of Roman military might. It's exceedingly strong. So Rome was stronger than the three previous empires and had great iron teeth. That's the same metal mentioned in the image of the statue. It corresponds to the iron legs. And it crushed those it conquered. It devoured them and broke them in pieces. And so the nations that were conquered were absorbed into the empire and exploited for the good of the empire. Then he says it stamped the residue with its feet. In other words, this emphasizes the vengeful attitude of the Romans. An example of this is their conquest of Carthage. This is described in Wikipedia. The Romans pulled the Phoenician warships out into the harbor and burned them before the city, and went from house to house, capturing, raping, and enslaving the people. 50,000 Carthaginians were sold into slavery. The city was set ablaze, and in this way was razed, and only ruins and rubble to field its aftermath. So the Romans annihilated it. They didn't have to, but they wreaked their vengeance on Carthage. Rome also crushed civilizations, says verse 7 and 8. This is something other nations did not do. For example, they crushed the Jewish nation in the Second Jewish Revolt, the Par Kokhba Revolt in 132 to 136. According to Cassius Dio, 580,000 Jews were killed and 50 fortified towns and 985 villages razed. Cassius Dio claimed that many Romans, moreover, perished in this war, and as a result, therefore, Hadrian, in writing to the Senate, did not employ the opening phrases commonly affected by the emperors. He did not say this: if you and your children are in health, it is well. I and the army are in health. The army was not in health. They suffered significant casualties. Therefore, Hadrian attempted to root out Judaism, which he saw as the cause of continuous rebellions. He prohibited the Torah law and the Hebrew calendar, and he executed Judaic scholars, and the sacred scroll was ceremonially burned on the Temple Mount. At the former temple sanctuary, he installed two statues, one of Jupiter, another of himself, in an attempt to erase any memory of Judea or ancient Israel, and he wiped the name off the map and replaced it with Syria-Palestinia, after the Philistines, the ancient enemies of the Jews. Previously, similar terms have been used to describe only the smaller, former Philistine homeland to the west of Judea. Since then, the land has been referred to as Palestine, which supplanted earlier terms such as Judea and Israel. Similarly, he reestablished Jerusalem as a Roman pagan polis, a Roman pagan city of Aelia Capitolina, and the Jews were forbidden from entering it. The majority of the Jewish population in Judea was either killed, exiled, or sold into slavery, and the Jewish religious and political authority was suppressed brutally. So Rome crushed civilizations. And you know, I think we can still see that influence today in the World Without Borders, a one world movement, where it's considered immoral to have borders and to have separate countries. These people who are influenced by Rome want to turn this into one great big happy kingdom, one world government. That's the effect of Rome on the modern world. It is still attempting to crush civilizations. Here in America, there are people who are trying to totally change American culture and American civilization. So we still see Rome at work and its influence around the world. It hasn't quite done it yet, but it is slowly but surely sending its tentacles around the entire world. Notice that Daniel also says that this beast was diverse from the beasts before it, and imperialism is a new form of government. And all nations served Rome alone. That's where we're going in this world today as well. And it had 10 horns corresponding to the 10 toes of the previous image in chapter 2. So the beast starts out with 10 horns, but after some time things change. And now we move into verse 8 and the tribulation period. And we come to the period of the little horn. Verse 8, while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it, and behold, the horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. So while he's meditating, carefully looking at and evaluating the 10 horns, he sees an 11th horn come up from among them. It's a little one, but it's powerful because it uproots 3 of the 10 horns, leaving 7 intact. And remember, the Antichrist is a very strong and vicious and brutal. The horn had the eyes of a man, so the horn had unique knowledge. The mouth spoke great things. It had personality. It was charismatic, and it was characterized by boasting. So this is Antichrist. We see this in 2 Thessalonians 2:3-8. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy come first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God and object of worship. See that arrogance, that boasting? So that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Do you not remember that while I was still with you, I was telling you these things? And you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he will be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. Then the lawless one will be revealed. The Antichrist will be revealed. He will come up out of the 10 horns. He will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. So that's a quick summary of the rise and fall of the Antichrist. This little horn is also the beast of Revelation 13. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast, the Antichrist. They worshiped the dragon, that's Satan, because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to wage war with him? See, he's brutal, he's strong, he's smart, he's clever. He's unique. He's not like your average human leader. And there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies. We just saw that back in 2 Thessalonians. And authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. The authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. See, destruction of civilizations, Rome crushing everything. All who dwell on the earth will worship him. Everyone whose name was not written from the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb who has been slain. So this is the beast. This is the beast. So this is the background of the key verses that we're going to look at. So now we're going to jump from verse 8 all the way to verses 23 to 26. And this section really compresses the far future, the Roman Empire and its beginning, the first coming, the tribulation, and the second coming. It all compresses it down into a very short number of verses. So they're hard to break apart. But now the angel is going to dig deeper into this vision that Daniel saw. He's going to give a detailed interpretation in verses 23 through 27. So we begin with the fourth beast of Roman republicanism and imperialism in verses 23 through 26. This is the Roman Empire. And remember, the major characteristic of this empire is change. It's going to go through 5 stages. We begin with the united stage in verse 23, which is the Roman Empire itself. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all other kingdoms. So this fourth kingdom, this fourth beast, is the fourth kingdom. It's diverse from all the other kingdoms because its government is imperialism and republicanism, a unique governmental system. And remember what imperialism is. Imperialism is the policy of extending a nation's authority by territorial acquisition or by the establishment of economic and political hegemony, leadership over other nations. So this is its unique governmental system. It started out as in a united stage. Then, in verse 23, it moves to a one-world government stage. This is stage two of political economic hegemony. And it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. That's the one-world government stage. And remember, it shall devour the whole earth. Daniel 2 mentioned a two-division stage, but here we jump to a worldwide stage. So remember, imperialism stage 1 was territorial acquisition, and Rome grew as large as it could possibly grow until it was an unmanageable empire. Then it switched to imperialism stage 2, the two-division stage, with the Western Roman Empire being governed by Rome and the Eastern Roman Empire being governed at Byzantium. But now we move to a universal stage. The whole earth is involved. This is imperialism stage 2, economic and political hegemony. Rome did not fall. Rome did not disappear. Rome simply changed and began to continue influence the world through economic and political hegemony, economic and political influence. Rome began to conquer the whole world, the whole earth. And so we have to account for this in our interpretation of these sections of Daniel. Rome has to go worldwide, and it does through economic and political hegemony. Now the terminology here in verse 3 is universal in scope. This is not new terminology. For example, Isaiah 6:3. And one called out to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. Same terminology used of the Roman Empire. And Zechariah 4:14. Then he said, these are the two anointed ones who are standing by who? The Lord of the whole earth. God is the Lord of the entire world. It's the same terminology used in Daniel. Now, Rome did not conquer the whole world or even the known world in the first stage of imperialism. Okay, remember, this is the maximum territory that Rome was able to conquer. And Rome still has not conquered the entire world. It's very close to it. We know that it hasn't conquered the entire world through its economic and political hegemony because when it succeeds in doing that, it's going to tread the world down and break it in pieces. This is a reference to the Antichrist and his brutal government. So we're not quite there yet, but we're getting awful close. We're getting awful close, folks. All right. Well, let's see where I am here. All right. I see I've only got a minute or so left. Well, let's move to verse 24 and the 10-division stage. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise. This is the 10 toes of Daniel 2 and the 10 horns of Daniel 7. This is the 10-division stage that arises out of the one-world government. Rome goes worldwide, and these 10 kingdoms are worldwide in nature. Now, many interpret this kingdom as a revived European Roman Empire, the European Union. But that can't be because that's just limited to Europe and the common market. And yet this worldwide kingdom is universal in size. It's universal. It's worldwide. And so continental unions are probably a better way to look at what's going to happen. Now, what's a continental union? A continental union often abbreviated to CU, is an intergovernmental supranational federation of member states located in the same continent or close to it. Continental unions are a relatively new type of political entity in the history of human government, and that fits Rome very, very well. There's some existing continental unions. The African Union, including all African countries except Morocco. The Commonwealth of Australia includes the continental mainland, Tasmania, and numerous smaller islands. The European Union includes 27 European countries out of 47, one Asian country, Cyprus, and territories in South America and Africa. The Union of South American Nations includes all of the continental South America, except French Guiana. And in addition to that, there are other proposed continental unions floating around. These proposals include the Asia Cooperation Dialogue, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the Central American Integration System, the Central Asian Union, the North American Union, the Pacific Union, the Union of Eastern Caribbean States, and the Cooperation Council for the Arab States of the Gulf. So I think this is a better scheme because the wording in verse 24 cannot limit this 10-division stage to Europe and the common market, even though this is a common approach. So continental unions, I think, is the best way to look at this. And now this is a common approach, for example, this common approach of seeing the European Union as the 10-division government. Contender Ministries takes this position. The EU today is made up of over 25 countries. However, the 10 nations of the Western European Alliance have a separate status as full members, while those nations who joined subsequent to the original 10 have associate membership or observer status. This 10-nation military wing of the EU may very well fulfill the prophecy of the beast with 10 horns from Daniel 7, 7, and 8 and Revelation 13, 1. Well, that doesn't go worldwide, so that doesn't work. Also, this article on the new kings and queens of Europe that appeared in the Jerusalem Post Christian edition in September of 2008. They stated, French President Nicolas Sarkozy, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and others in July have engineered a new collective entity called the Mediterranean Union. This proposed new union will embrace North Africa, Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, and at some point fold them into the European Union, and presto, we have the old Roman Empire resurrected. Well, no, I'm sorry. The Roman Empire has to go worldwide, and so this will not work. This will not work. All right, I'm out of time. I've used up 3 minutes or more of your time. I will not give it back to you. I'm sorry. And we'll pick it up next session as we move into, we continue on in chapter 7, verse 24, and we'll move to the next stage of the Revelation, the Antichrist stage, or the Little Horn stage. So we'll, that's not what I wanted to do. There we go. And so we will see you next session. So thanks so much for being our students. See you next session. Lehitraot.